for a large proportion of the world's population, in terms of earning hard currency, they depend upon the export of simple primary commodities, coffee, cotton, things like that. Since 1980, in the last 20 odd years, the real price of all commodities, apart from oil, that most of the very poorest countries depend upon for their export trade and their foreign exchange earnings, have halved in value in real terms. And yet, the message you still hear is export your way to development. It's setting countries up to fail. Or, in another sense, given the fluctuations, the enormous fluctuations in the global economy, it's a little bit like taking quite a poor family that have got a few thousand dollars saved and saying, okay, we want you to invest for your children's future. We want you to go to the casino down the road and throw your $5,000 on Red 27. You know, that's the kind of message which is being sent from the major financial institutions to developing countries. It's, you know, they call it collective adjustment. It's just a rather obvious observation that if a group of countries who, by and large, produce very similar things, all produce more of the same things, surprise, surprise, their value will go down. The other thing I just wanted to say, which I think provides a context for our debate, is there's all the questions about distribution, there's all the questions about poverty eradication, but there's also a question when we talk about trade about living within our environmental budget. Just to give you an illustration of how the global economy has been developing over the last few decades, we've gone from a situation where in 1950 there was virtually zero air freight. And air freight's interesting because it's one of the most fuel-intensive ways of moving stuff around the world. And it's one of the fastest rising contributors to climate change and global warming, which in various places around the world is actually destroying people's chances of development, whatever, quite literally in some circumstances. But just to give you an illustration, we've gone from a situation of having virtually no stuff air freighted around the world to the equivalent of a ton of goods flying 100 billion kilometers every year. It's kind of silly numbers. It's almost impossible to picture. And there's a lot more facts and figures like that. Now, alternatives. Very briefly, the most common accusation thrown at people who are critical of globalization, as usual, is that they have no alternatives. Rubbish. 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 For the last decade and more, organizations that have real experience of what it's like on the front line of the global economy have been turning up at World Bank meetings, IMF meetings, World Trade Organization meetings, G7 meetings, the World Economic Forum, whatever, with detailed, worked out plans for what you need to do to reduce financial, you know, stability in the global financial markets, for what you need to do to get a better deal for developing countries in trade terms, for what you need to do to help us live within our planetary environmental budget. And from the perspective of the New Economics Foundation, a lot of these perspectives are finding their way into a very broad sort of umbrella movement, which is calling itself localization. Now, localization is not about doing everything that you need to do in the economy 100 yards down the road. What it is about doing is asking the question, at what level should whichever part of the economy you're talking about operate? At the lowest possible level, to keep it in touch with people and to help it live within environmental parameters. So it's that old word subsidiarity that our friend Mr. Schumacher gave us about doing things at the lowest appropriate level to help us live within environmental limits and have the economy work in such a way that it meets people's needs. And there's increasingly useful little tools that are being developed by organizations like our own that help us to work out what that means. A great woman who's written on this subject for many, many years, Jane Jacobs, talks about the import stretching ratio as a way of working out how best to use inputs coming into your local economy. We talk about the local multiplier effect. And just to give you an example of that, very briefly, if we did some research in the south of England, and we found out that a pound spent on a local food initiative was worth £2.59 to the local economy in terms of the way that the money recirculated in the local economy. A pound spent in a big major multiple supermarket was only worth about £1.40 to the local economy. Now scale up and look at that in lots and lots of different circumstances, and you have a stunning difference in the ability to generate wealth where it's needed, in communities where it's needed. And just in the UK example, the difference was that If you took all the money spent on local food in the UK, which is worth about £3.6 billion, if all of that was spent in big major multiples in supermarkets, kind of the equivalent of Walmart or whatever, there would be a multiplier effect, but the multiplier effect would mean that it was worth about £5 billion. If it was spent through locally rooted businesses, it was worth something more like £9.3 billion. So there are core dynamics that can help us turn around the way that the global economy works, not like an efficient irrigation system of wealth, but the way that it really works, like a giant vacuum cleaner, sucking wealth up from the grassroots and concentrating it in a very small number of people at the top of the pile. So when people say we're all about opposition and we've got nothing else to say that's constructive, just turn around and say rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. And if you want the details and if you want the references, go look at our website. Follow our website through to other people's websites where all this research is building up. There was a chapter in the World Disasters Report published by the International Red Cross last year that looked at the efficiency of these kind of systems for helping the poorest countries in the most environmentally vulnerable locations recover from disasters. These are tools which work from the most extreme circumstances of human duress right through to your local neighborhood here in New York State. That's my little potted intro. And I'll just kind of round off with saying some research that I've been doing. I had to visit a very small South Pacific island called Tuvalu, which some people might have heard of, a few months ago. And Tuvalu is fascinating because it's a very, very tiny place. It's a full nation, but has only between 9 and 11,000 people living there. And what's distinguishing Tuvalu is that the highest point that it is above sea level is about 4 meters. And so understandably, the impact of climate change is showing itself increasingly. But what we stand to lose with Tuvalu is more than just a nation state, because the way that Tuvalu's economy used to be organized was in a way that enabled me to actually kind of imagine and visualize and believe in the fact that we can organize things fundamentally differently, because their economy for thousands of years, and certainly for the recorded history of the last couple of hundred, has been based not upon competition, but upon gift giving and sharing. And not only did this mean that they have a much more equal society, a much more tolerant society, and a much less violent society, it also meant that they had an enormously resilient social structure, which has actually enabled them, given their extreme isolation and the fact that they've been suffering from environmentally extreme weather for many years, but it's enabled them to survive for about 2,000 years in one of the most extreme environments it's possible to be in. And now, in the space of very, very few years, two things have happened. One is that the modern market economy has moved in and turned large parts of the island into a rubbish tip. It's destroyed a lot of their local resilient social structures, which have enabled them to survive in that area. And to add kind of insult to injury, climate change is also worsening the extreme conditions that they've survived for so long. And the final irony, a unique irony and a unique paradox of the modern age, is that Tuvalu won the lottery of the information age when it sold its internet domain name, .tv, for about $30 million Australian. But the irony was that just at the time that they had benefited from selling their virtual domain, they were losing their real one. This stuff is about real life. And on that note, I'm going to introduce Steve Keen, who's going to show you some numbers and some really flash graphs. Steve, thank you for listening.
Well, I've got to start by reiterating the thank you that Andrew gave for you being here this time of the morning. It's remarkable to have an audience of this size in a city this cold this early in the morning. I come from a much warmer climate, so I get away with statements like that. As Andrew mentioned, I'm the author of a book called Debunking Economics, and this is a chapter that is not in the book. I'll explain why it's not in the book after I've finished. What I do in this book is go through conventional economic theory, but rather unlike like a Vanity Fair magazine, I leave the warts on. And you see the model not as it turns up in the gloss, but as she wakes up in the morning. And I'm afraid with this particular model, you wouldn't be hanging around. The theory is so bad, so stupid, that it's phenomenal, as Andrew said a moment ago, that so many people with so many degrees continue to spout this stuff and believe it. And my feeling about the people who push this theory forward is not that they are malicious, which is often the interpretation we put upon things like the World Economic Forum. They actually believe this stuff. They're zealots. And that's a lot more dangerous. Now, if you take a good look at the theory and look from a dispassionate intellectual point of view and a mathematical point of view as well, believe me, there's no mathematics in this presentation, by the way, but I will go through why the theory is mathematically wrong at various points in the book. They're asking the wrong questions, for a start, and they're even giving the wrong answers to those wrong questions in their own thinking. If we go back and see why are we in this room, why are we protesting against what's happening down the road? What's actually happening down the road is a de-democratisation of our world. And why is it happening? It's because economists don't trust democracy. The reason is they have a near universal belief in the superiority of free trade. And that applies not just to economists who are of the conservative persuasion, but quite a few economists who I would classify as progressive in their politics in various ways. They've all been seduced by this theory. But they can't convince the public. And if you look at their literature, what they blame is two things. First of all, they blame ignorance. This is from a fairly potent technical textbook. Although perhaps the area of economics least understood by laymen and, alas, many undergraduates, the theory of comparative advantage is essentially very simple. And on goes the book to explain the simple arguments. And they also blame myopic self-interest. They say that it's actually the politicians who are using their position of power to make a personal gain out of offering protection to different industries. So here's another one. In recent years, there has been a growing awareness of why legislators are prepared to supply protection in order to promote their selfish political interests. Now, if you can read the subtext of the feeling that economist has about politicians and the way they portray people who work in the public arena in general, not just politicians but public servants as well, you can see why they just don't trust anything that isn't sold and traded on the market. And they want to make everything market-based. But they don't believe they can get to this nirvana of theirs, their utopia, through the political process. So what do? They avoid politics. And they say, well, we've got these advantages. We know free trade is good. We know protection is bad. We can't explain it to the public. They're just too dumb to understand this sophisticated thinking. And we can't stop selfish politicians and interest groups making their own gain out of it. So what do? Simple. We take trade policy out of the hands of the public. And that's where we get MAI and GATS and the World Trade Organization. All these sorts of institutions are a tactical response by economists who sincerely believe that free trade will benefit the world. They sincerely believe they're doing us good. It's their political tactical response to not being able to get their way through the normal political democratic channels. So they take all of this stuff out of the political channels and they sidestep democracy for the common good. And that's what they're actually doing. That's their belief. So in that case, they're saying in some ways that free trade's a bit like castor oil. Now, we know it's good for you, but we can't make the kids drink it without holding their throats and shoving it down with a spoon. Well, is that really the case? Let's take a good look at the theory. Free trade argues that we should all specialise. It says that the best way the world can progress is unlike the case that Andrew was making a while ago and which Keynes made many, many years ago, or unlike doing as much as we can at the local level. We should do as little as we can at the local level and simply specialise at what we're best at. And Ricardo gave us this theory back in the early 1800s. And what he was fighting against was the mercantilists who tried to get as much as possible done locally and import as little, and that also paradoxically tried to export as much at the same time. But mercantilists used to say that the main rival of England then was Portugal, and if we had free trade, Portugal would defeat England in everything. Now, Portugal would be better at making wine, better at making this, better at making that, and they'd devastate English industry if we opened up to free trade, so we can't do that. Well, what Ricardo did was take that argument. He actually said, well, I'm going to assume that Portugal is better at doing everything than England. Better at making wine, better at making cloth, and I'm still going to show that we'd be better off if everybody specialises. And England specialises what it's best at, which is cloth, and Portugal specialises in wine. And the model he used, he put down in numerical terms, a numerical example. And he had two countries, Portugal and England, producing two commodities, which were wine and cloth. And he said, Portugal's absolutely better at producing both of those. With the same number of Portuguese workers, they can produce more of either commodity than the English can. But, being Portuguese, they're relatively better at producing wine. I think that's still the case, isn't it? So, better at making wine than cloth, but better at both than England is. And he says, you'll produce more of both wine and cloth if England specialises just in cloth, shuts down its wine industry. Portugal specialises just in wine, shuts down its cloth industry, and we trade the surpluses. We'll have more total production, trade the extra bit, we'll both be better off. And there'll be increased consumption of both goods in both countries. Now, to go through the numbers that he used, he said, let's say we work on a basis of per 1,000 workers. How much can Portugal produce? Well, he said, let's say it takes 90 workers in Portugal to produce a particular quantity, X, doesn't matter what it is, X units of cloth. And 80 workers to produce Y units of wine. So that's the number of workers that Portugal needs. Whereas England, but it can then produce 11.1 units of cloth, whatever we might measure cloth in metres or 100 yards, whatever, and 12.5 units of wine. But that's thousands of litres or whatever number. It doesn't really, the number itself is the main thing rather than the unit of measurement. And you can then make any straight line combination of the two. So you put 11.1 on one axis and 12.5 on the other, as I'm going to do in a graph shortly, and you can be anywhere along the straight line joining the two. England per 1,000 workers takes 100 workers to produce X cloth, so rather than the 90 in Portugal it takes 100 to produce the cloth in England, but it takes 120 workers to produce the same amount of wine as Portugal does, rather than 80, so it's much less efficient at making wine than it is of cloth. So we can produce either 10 units of cloth, or 8.5 units of wine, or any combination of the two. Now, what I'm going to do now, once my computer responds, is put this in a graph. Actually, this is Ricardo's statement coming up shortly. But if you then work it out, you've got a maximum of 11.1 units of cloth for Portugal, 12.5 for wine, England 10 of cloth, 8.33 for wine. If you have trade, you get a total output from Portugal of 12.5 units of wine. It makes nothing but wine. England makes 10 units of cloth. And overall, there's more produced than otherwise when they both try to do as much as they can of each. Exchange the surpluses, total output's greater, everybody benefits. Now, to put this in diagrammatic form, I'm going to show you the sort of way that economists are seduced into believing this stuff. Okay. I don't know whether I've persuaded you yet with this case, but I'm going to go forwards and backwards with this argument. So let's look in graphical form. And we put cloth on the horizontal axis and wine on the vertical axis. And there's England, with a little line down the bottom there, and there's Portugal, which can produce more of both of those things with the same number of workers. And let's say England produces at that little dot point there, and Portugal produces there. Well, to add them two together, I just use a parallelogram. And if I whack a parallelogram here, there's total output. That's total output of both wine and cloth in the world consisting of those two countries. There's wine output without trade and cloth output without trade, where those two yellow lines come up. Then we add the magic ingredient. There's world output with no trade. Let's add the magic ingredient of free trade and see what happens. What it means with free trade is both those dots move out to the extreme that they can, and you expand the parallelogram. And what then happens is England moves from producing both cloth and wine to just cloth, so it goes from that point out to the axis, and there's cloth output with trade. Portugal goes from its point out to the axis and there's wine output with trade, and here's your new parallelogram, it's actually the axes, and boom, there's your increase in trade. And so students seeing this case for the first time are often seduced, wow, hey, nice graphics. Okay. Both countries are better off, and off we go. And the modern argument, 200 years later, only makes it more sophisticated really by using curves rather than straight lines. Now brace yourselves. I was going to say when I started my presentation that I was going to be your Java for the morning. I think Andrew was that. He certainly woke everybody up. This may be your comatose experience as you try to interpret the next diagram. Bear with me. I'll build it up slowly. And this is the stuff that students are still taught as the fundamental foundation of the theory of free trade today. And all they've really done is bend the curves and try to whack on some representation of consumer tastes to work out what actual amounts will be traded and what the prices are. This is called the Heckscher-Ohlin theory of international trade, and it's derived from the Nordic countries rather than America, but like a lot of garbage, America adopted it very happily. Okay, let's say we have America here producing both shoes and computers, PCs. Shoes, I'm going to say, are labour-intensive to make, and computers are capital-intensive to make. And America, as we know, has more capital than it has labour compared to other parts of the world. What they draw is what they call a production possibility curve, and they say there's some trade-off for moving from one point to another. It's using what they call their favourite concept is a thing called diminishing marginal productivity. I won't try to explain that now. I do in my book, and I rubbish it. But that's what they draw to represent production. So they say America can produce anywhere along that curved line. Whereabouts do they produce? Well, that depends upon consumer tastes. And you then draw another thing called a social indifference curve, showing each of those, anyone along any one of those curves, we're saying any point along that curve makes America in general as happy as any other point. So way up the top with lots of PCs and a small number of shoes, America's just as happy as it is way down the other end with a few PCs and lots of shoes. And that's supposed to represent consumer tastes. And then the point you actually produce at is where those two curves are tangents, because obviously the more PCs you have and the more shoes you have, from an economist's point of view, the better off you are. So the point you actually produce at is that point where those two curves kiss each other, as close as economists ever get to sex. And the price of sex is the slope of the line through there, and that shows the relative price of shoes to PCs in America without trade. And that's the price ratio, in effect, the slope of that line. Well, how do you add trade? Well, this is really fancy stuff, guys. We turn the graph upside down and whack another country in there. Here comes Japan. Pardon me, about Mexico. Okay. And Mexico, we know, has got lots of labour and not very much capital. So it's better at it has more of what you need to produce shoes than what you produce PCs. And without trade, it's got its own set of indifference curves, its own production possibility frontier, its own relative price, which differs from the American one. And what they then do is this is the next stage, this is, I suppose, the first kiss is the first date, and we're now gone to the real orgasm of free trade, because you continue working out what you trade by moving out to the point where your two indifference curves now touch, and that curve is now where you determine the price ratio. This is the free trade ratio. This is the price ratio that now applies with trade. So you take that price ratio there, and you then say, well, that's now going to be the price of rules in both countries. And of course, that's going to change how attractive it is to make PCs in one country versus making shoes in another, and it'll change both where people produce and where they consume. So to work out where they produce, you now take that curve and you bring it down against the production possibility frontier for America, and you say, well, America's now going to move from its point where it consumes and produces at the black dot that I've got there to where it now produces a lot less shoes and a lot more PCs. Okay, I've got producing more shoes, haven't I? I better change that graph for later use. Just imagine I didn't stuff that up. So they change their production position, but they now, where they consume is along the same trade line. They actually trade along that price ratio, and they move out to the best possible consumption pattern for them along this new price ratio, and that's where they consume. And what's actually happened, you see that little blue arrow I've got there, that's taken them outside their production possibility frontier, which means, from an economist's point of view, they're now consuming more than they could possibly produce on their own. And the same trick applies on the Mexican side. So what you have is consumption outside your production possibility curve. Whoopie-doo, that's the benefit of free trade. Now, I'm not joking. That is the case which the students get at normally third-year level as undergraduates. They get it mathematically in master's and PhD courses. They try to elaborate it in various ways, including what they call imperfect competition and stuff like that. But that's really about it. And I reckon that's pretty clear, don't you? I mean, you know, nobody's going to question that. Well, I've got a simple little question for it, which is, how do you turn a shoe factory into a computer factory? Well, according to economists, it's really quite simple. You just wave a magic wand. Boom! Instant change. Okay. Simple as that. Capital can move freely from one industry to another without loss. Bullshit. Okay. Reality is rather different. If you have a movement of capital in America from producing shoes to producing PCs, you start with a set of prices which are pre-trade trade prices. If you open up trade, you've made shoes cheaper in America because you're importing Mexican shoes now. So the price of shoes in America is going to fall. The factory that produces those shoes can't make computers. It's very hard to explain this to an economist. I hope I don't have to work hard with you people, but the shoe factory can't really make PCs. So you've got to sell the thing. And of course you're going to get a lower price for it because the shoe factory in America is not worth what it was worth beforehand. The price has dropped. You then have less capital, which you then have to use to build a computer factory, and you'll have less capacity in the shoe producing area. You have less capacity in the computer industry than you expected to have. You'll have depressed areas where the shoes were produced beforehand, and what you have there will have is a destruction of capital, and of course also a destruction of labour. But I tend to work with capital because that seems to have more appeal to economists than labour. So what economic theory is ignoring is time. It takes time to move from one point to another. And I remember one of the speakers in the morning session or the beginning of the conference making the comment about the rapid reduction of tariff barriers and trade barriers is what we're opposed to. And it's true. It's the speed at which you do things that matters, and economic theory completely ignores time, so you can do things as fast as you like because time doesn't exist. Wonderful. It ignores the uniqueness of capital. The capital make a shoe is rather different to the capital involved in making a PC, but they think they can treat it as exactly the same thing. And it ignores the specific skills of labour. It takes a while to learn how to make a shoe. Probably it takes more skill to make a shoe than it does to be a worker on a production line in most computer factories. And it ignores the distribution of income. It presumes if we transfer from capital to labour, well, that doesn't really matter. Interesting theory. Reality is quite different. If you have, let's try that graph, and you say, let's make the opening up of free trade, what you do is you're going to diminish the capacity of America to produce shoes. And if you actually try to do it using this crazy thing called the production possibility frontier, you'd have to move it down to show the destruction of capital, which of course they don't do. You're going to have destruction of unprofitable capital, and those regions will be depressed as a result. So you can't convert capital or labour from one use to another without loss. And the amount you lose is a function of how quickly you do it. Of course, these guys want to do this stuff as fast as possible. Andrew was speculating about why it is that we have two Australians on this panel. We're not exactly we're overrepresented in population terms in the world, obviously. And I was thinking about it before I got here and asked Andrew, when did Thatcher start in England, which is when we base most of our complaints about this total free market, commodified approach to the world. 1979 was the answer. Well, in 1973, our Labour government, progressive Labour government, cut tariffs 25% overnight without warning. You simply woke up in the morning and tariffs were cut by 25%. Because they'd been sold on this particular case. Do it instantly, and capital move from one point to another. And of course, sane people like myself and Graham have been shaking our heads ever since, trying to find what the hell happened? How did they get sold on this idea? How can we turn them around? So we've had that experience, that instant cut in tariffs, and we saw the destruction, but the economists didn't see it. I'll give you an anecdote from that later, which I still find amazing, from a Labour Party politician. So we've destroyed capital and invested in the less competitive industries. It'll make shoe producers in America worse off, and PC producers in Mexico, if there are such things. It inflates the value of capital, the dollar value of capital, but that dollar increase in value doesn't really change how productive the machinery is. It takes time to build that capacity. So we need an analysis of how trade develops and how trade affects things like investment, innovation, employment, but we don't get it in economics. They do not consider those issues because they involve the analysis of change over time, and economists know nothing about analysing change over time. On top of that, the ideologies between free trade theory and globalisation as it's practiced now are quite inconsistent. The theory of free trade assumes that capital and labour, which they call factors of production, can move without loss between industries. So you can move capital from producing shoes to producing PCs, exactly the same value of capital, instant transfer from one spot to another. They also assume that all the incomes that are earned remain in the country where they're earned. But the globalisation we're protesting about here involves overriding rights of transnational corporations, which can't exist under the theory of free trade, free movement of capital but not labour, uninhibited repatriation of profits. So we've got a theory and a practice or an argument based on a theory which are completely out of whack. Their predictions also have failed, and this is some of the stuff Andrew's mentioned beforehand. For example, one of the predictions of the theory is that capital-intensive industries like the USA will export capital-intensive products and import labour-intensive ones. When a guy called Leontief, who's one of the world's few very sensible economists in the past, a man who knew a bit about production, did the research, he found that on the statistics as defined, the USA only imported exported labour-intensive and imported capital-intensive. And this was found for many other nations, And it should have been seen as a disproof of the theory. If you had a theory like this in a sane science, and you were getting results which always counted to what you predicted, yes, people would to some extent try to find reasons to modify the theory to suit, but they wouldn't label it a paradox. That's what they did. They called it a paradox, not a disproof. So it's Leontief paradox. They tried to explain the result away rather than question the theory, because in their minds, the theory is unquestionable. And the same for other predictions they've made. So on top of that, the actual theory has foundations of sound. That smooth curve I used to draw to supposedly show people's preferences of the whole society. This is an economist talking about them. Community, indifference and utility, possibly low-key, aren't they great words, are amongst the most useful concepts of welfare economics. The greatest disadvantage is they may intersect. In other words, those smooth curves I drew should be bouncing all over each other, and the analysis becomes inconclusive. So what they prefer to draw is something like that, a smooth curve. But when you look at what they can draw, it should look like that. Now, if you try to find the point of best intersection there with the other stuff I was drawing, well, good luck. How do they cope? Well, they then theorize, look at this, identical preferences and proportional incomes, meaning we all have exactly the same tastes, and those tastes don't change with income. And they make that assumption. They call it the Sonnenschein-Mandel de Broglie conditions and teach it in advanced theory. And they make that to get away with drawing these curves, smooth curves. So their theory is just absolute crap, I'm afraid to say. And output the same story. They try to represent that by a smooth curve, and they draw this thing they call a circular flow diagram, where you have firms that produce goods and services and sell them to households, and households then pay for them. No complaints there. But they then say on the other side that wages and profits get paid to households, and in return households supply capital and labour. Well, capital and labour. Okay, households do supply labour, but what capital does a household supply? The best it can do is dollars. Okay, not many of your houses turn out industrial lathes and supply them with factories. But it's only possible that relationship that gives you a smooth curve applies if dollars actually produce goods. Now, economists actually prefer to reason that way. I go through the mathematics in a verbal sense in my book in Chapter 6, which is the most difficult chapter of the book, and show the theory of production is wrong. So what they draw to represent production, what they draw to represent consumer taste, they're all intellectually invalid in their own terms, let alone taking into account more complex arguments. So, going through it quickly, the things we worry about, what will happen to our assets? What will it do to unemployment? How will it affect innovation, investment? How will it alter the distribution of income? They're all dynamic issues, and they're all ignored by the static theory that economists teach themselves and promulgate. They favour on these static gains from trade on the nonsense assumption that we can move capital and labour around without destroying them and without losing any capacity. And it assumes dynamic outcomes are the same as static. So their theory is wrong, it's internally wrong, it's asking the wrong questions, it's giving the wrong answers to the wrong questions, it's useless as a guide to what will happen with globalisation. From my point of view, what happens with globalisation is the faster you reduce those barriers, the more you destroy resources, human and capital. And the more you diminish investment, the less growth capacity you have. And you get a two-nations economy within a two-world planet. Paper wealth in the first world and third and finance markets, and poverty in the globalised industries. If we're going to have change in this direction at all, and it's an interesting case as to how far we should change that, I have a lot of sympathy for Keynes's arguments. Gradual change is what we should have, and the dynamic effect of gradual change can be quite different to these static gains. We could have more globalisation in some sense, even the way they wish to do it, if they would do it slowly. But they can't be persuaded to think of that in terms of how fast things could be done. Now, if you look at the arguments economists give, comparative advantage, what should Japan be producing today? Silk. Well, I'm sorry, that's not what it produces. That's not how it made its money. So the critics of globalisation are right to reject the assurances that the opponents give that globalisation will benefit all, and they're right to demand policies that defend the weak and look at income distribution and take it seriously. And they should also demand true scientific analysis of issues rather than the simplistic dogma that economists actually promulgate. So let's have a bit of fun at 12 o'clock. Thank you.
Oh, no. Yeah, sure. Okay. There's some seats available right at the front if you don't want to stand. If you've been walking around too much, you're probably going to be on your feet for the rest of the day.
There's three or four around here, and there's still quite a few up there.
Be brave, sit on the front row.
Oh, no. I might be able to copy that off you, because mine didn't record after all that.
I think that's the whole thing. I think we're going to be recorded several times over.
Good idea. Oh, thank you. I'm catching a plane at 6:45, but if I can still manage, if I can come along to that, I think I can make that in time. Okay, sure.
Give him a chance to settle. Okay, everyone, now you're all sitting a little bit more comfortably, hopefully. Isn't economics great? It comes up with phrases like social indifference curve. Isn't that what a fabulous phrase? I mean, I suppose the best thing is that everybody here is not socially indifferent, and that's why you're here. And Steve talking about the two nations economy and the two world planet. Brazil was to reach the same US. We'd need another two planets. I think elsewhere I've seen a similar calculation that we might need up to eight planets. And I made this point in a public talk a couple of weeks ago. And this guy came up to me afterwards and he said, No, Andrew, you've got it all wrong. You've got it all wrong. You don't understand. We need millions of more planets. And my sort of answer to him was, well, yeah, maybe fair enough, but surely the point is that if we need any more than the one we've got, then we're in trouble. So we have to kind of... completely irrelevant to Graham's presentation, but I'd like to welcome Graham Dunkley now, whose book, The Free Trade Adventure, is available from the same publisher as Steve's. And over to you, Graham.
Good. Thanks, Andrew. I'm very pleased to be here, and I've enjoyed the conference so far. My method is rather different from Steve's, and there's a gentleman going around here very kind of, it's a rather late production, and some photocopies of my paper have been made, and there is a diagram that will help to refer to. What you've got to understand is I'm an example of the case Steve was referring to. I can't transfer my brain from this method to his method. So you've got the old method in my case. So many people now may have to share copies of the paper, but you can hear what I'm saying, but there is a diagram that would help if some people can see it. And if you can get hold of a copy later, there'll be some of my some of the quotes and so on. Now, I've entitled my paper "Free Trade Theory: Swings, Roundabouts, and Contingencies," which is probably not a terribly interesting title, but it describes an alternative view that I'm trying to argue about free trade theory. And in fact, the title of my new book is to be something like "Free Trade Mythologies," because it's a surprising number of mythologies connected with free trade in all sorts of ways, which I go into. Now, actually, oddly enough, some of the sorts of groups that have accepted some of these mythologies are some NGOs, including unions. I've often, they used to be heavily involved in the labour movement, including at the time Steve was talking about when they cut tariffs, and a lot of the trade unions, oddly enough, supported the tariff cuts on the grounds that it was make the economy more efficient and things like that. And I hadn't meant to say this, but Steve mentioning the anecdote reminded me that a friend of mine was involved with some of the decision making of the Labor government, and he was at a conference where they discussed the policy, and somebody pointed out the relocational problem that Steve mentioned and made a major point of, and this bureaucrat said, oh well, workers will just have to make a suboptimal relocation decision. And that was another piece of jargon. That's not even mainstream jargon. He made that up on the spur of the moment. And that's another thing that economists can do very readily too. They make up things like that on the run. However, a number of NGOs and some trade and even trade unions now are tending to argue things like free trade is all right in theory, the problem is in the practice. If you've got inequalities, that mucks it up, and so therefore you have to have fair trade. Otherwise, it's all right. Well, I actually rather strongly disagree with that. I'm going to want to argue that free trade theory, for actually some additional reasons to what Steve outlined, is fundamentally flawed, and that free trade is actually not a good idea in theory, let alone in practice. And so we shouldn't be going around saying free trade is a good idea in theory, we just have to make the practice a bit better, because I don't believe that's actually true. There are a couple of aspects of free trade theory. One's the comparative advantage component that Steve was talking about. The other component that I want to focus on is the component known as gains from trade. Now, it's absolutely fundamental to the whole globalization project that there are gains from trade. The gains from trade theory, more than really the comparative advantage aspect, which Steve indicated the simplistic level is actually probably arguably true, the argument that there are gains from trading is absolutely fundamental to the globalization project. I've talked to businessmen, I've been asked to speak at business conferences at times and give my views, and they always come up with the same thing. But there are gains from trade, aren't there? And I say, well, no, actually, the theory doesn't say that entirely, for reasons I'll go into today. The gains from trade theory is fundamental to arguments for free trade in goods, the increasing argument for free trade in services, which has been pushed more and more by the WTO, even to some extent for free capital markets, even for intellectual property, except there that's not free, it's actually for restrictions. All of this is related to the idea of specialisation, and it's fundamental to the globalisation project, and if that is flawed, the whole globalisation project is flawed. If this one simple little theory that there are gains from trade is flawed, the entire globalisation project is flawed. And that's precisely what I argue is the case. If you listen to the people down the road and so on, the World Economic Forum, they will tell you things like free trade is a process of specialisation which brings about benefits to everyone, virtually all countries and virtually all people in those countries, more or less automatically, absolutely assured. That's the sort of view they have. Now, there's an interesting thing about this. Do you know who doesn't say that? Most economists. Most economists do not argue that. And for this new book, I've been going through some of the classic views. And this questioning that I decided I wanted to come up with, I started reading back through some of the views. And do you know who was arguing that? Most of the great trade theorists. Certainly right back to John Stuart Mill, leaving aside Smith and Ricardo because their versions were early versions. Once they got into diagrams and mathematics from John Stuart Mill onwards, they were saying these sorts of things. John Stuart Mill, with some arguments going on, quite a few economists in the 19th century opposed free trade on various reasons. John Stuart Mill was convinced of at least two. What's known as the terms of trade argument, which is where a large country can trade if it's got enough demand, it can raise the prices. And that's against its own interests. Then when it goes to free trade, it loses that advantage. Also the infant industry argument, as it was known. And from there on, various other arguments were gradually accepted to why free trade was not a good idea, at least in all circumstances. They came up with the possibility of undermining employment, partly for reasons Steve went into, macro balance, balance of payments, dumping, low-cost dumping, and the concept of externalities. That's where the benefits are less than the costs of any one social decision. That's where there are costs of one kind or another to any particular thing that's done. Most of the stuff that's been talked about at this conference, economists would lump under the heading of externalities. The problems with free trade in Mexico that people were talking about yesterday and all this sort of thing. And if you can convince a lot of economists that there are these externalities, that the costs are greater than the benefits of any particular policy item, they will tend to accept it. It's just that with all this stuff about the environmental and labour impacts of free trade, most economists don't quite accept it. They think that's unduly pessimistic. But I've met quite a lot of economists that would accept that free trade is not a very good idea if they could be completely convinced of the evidence, and they should have been at this conference in the last 2 days with the evidence that's been presented. So I've got a list of economists here. It's sort of a name dropping in a way, but almost all the major ones, Mill, Marshall, even Heckscher and Olin, who Steve was mentioning, the terribly elaborate theory he had up there, but both of them had certain doubts about free trade, and Olin looked at it in regional terms and gave some reasons why regional trade may be slightly better. Certainly Keynes, Hicks, and people like Samuelson accept some of the arguments against free trade. Now Samuelson, who comes from this country, of course, a Nobel laureate and probably the greatest living trade economist, theorist, has recently, in some rather obscure articles, unfortunately, conceded the problem of differing labour standards for free trade, and has suggested that self-reliance is actually feasible for reasons that I will go into in the new book, but there's not much time now. Overall, Samuelson has suggested that trade theory only says that the world is better off with some trade than no trade. And not all countries are necessarily better off, and not all individuals are going to be better off. Now, that's the world's greatest trade theorist. He doesn't say trade theory. He does not say trade theory. He does not say that free trade is the best policy in all circumstances for all countries and all people. And that's really quite amazing that that doesn't get emphasised. And you can actually read through whole economics textbooks and not in international economics and not know that the world's greatest trade theorist says that. And it's really quite staggering. Other theorists who I call sub-mainstream or non-mainstream or sometimes heretics, of course, go even further still, and I go further still than people like Samuelson. And they look at issues like unequal exchange, lock-in. If you develop in one direction, you can lock yourself into an area that may not be beneficial to you. The link between trade and development, the need for food security, social stability, and even what I call community, sovereignty and cultural arguments for free trade. Sorry, against free trade. Other theorists go further in arguing against free trade by looking at those sorts of things. On those sorts of grounds, you can argue against free trade. In the late 19th century, a number of mainstream economists, most notably Edgeworth and Marshall, the top economists of the day, started having some doubts about free trade. And they came up with a very interesting perspective. And the great Alfred Marshall, who was the Keynes of his day, said on a number of occasions in his books, and again you won't read this in the mainstream economics textbooks, he came up with the point, he said, actually free trade is a flawed theory. Free trade is flawed in theory, but it is best in practice. And the reason why it's best in practice is that if you don't have free trade, what are you going to have? You've got to have intervention by government. Governments are imperfect, they can be corrupted, in which his day it was, and of course we do know that that happens, can't deny that. But it's pessimistic to say governments are always going to fail. So that was the reason. The governments, they can't pick winners, they can't do things right. But free trade theory itself is flawed. The theory is flawed. The greatest economists have said free trade theory is flawed. And yet you don't read that in textbooks. Why don't you? And then from the 1960s on, another interesting theory was brought up by some of the top-level economists of the day, including the Canadian economist Richard Lipsy, who has written textbooks. And you will read this in his textbook, but not many others. He pointed out that free trade is what he called first best option because of all the sort of things that Steve pointed out. He accepted that theory. However, he said it doesn't always work out. It's not always possible to have free trade because markets are not always free. You've got to have all markets free. And if you haven't got all markets working perfectly, then there's no point in having it at all. To free up, to liberalise one area of the economy, it doesn't help much. And you don't hear the World Bank saying this. You have to fall back to what's called second best theory. And second best might involve some intervention. If you can't get to the best, which is complete free trade, you may as well have quite a few different levels of intervention. And actually behind this, this theory is the reason why modern day economic rationalism, as we call it in Australia, free market theory, tries to push for liberalisation of all markets at once because they know that the system won't work unless you have complete liberalisation. And it's probably, this is my guess, it's probably impossible to ever have all markets perfect. So in other words, we're probably always going to be living in the second best world where there are actually good arguments for intervention by governments that mainstream economists accept at the second best level. We probably will always live at the second best level. And so, again, that's a mainstream argument for intervention in free trade that you don't hear about very much. And new schools of economic thought have been coming up. You're probably all familiar with the name of Paul Krugman, a great economist from this country. I don't know what Steve feels about his underlying theories, but he's been doing some very interesting stuff at the real world level. And he's really quite a brilliant economist in many ways. And he has come up with the idea that there are even more reasons to intervene in the economy when you have monopolistic situations, oligopoly. Steve, in his book, actually argues that monopoly is efficient in some circumstances. And that may be true. But mainstream theory says monopoly and oligopoly is not good. Not because they can manipulate the world, which they can, only because it's inefficient. That's what economists worry about. But nevertheless, they do say it's not a good idea. So when you have that, when you have increasing returns and learning by doing and so on, then free trade is not always the best. These are mainstream theorists. In fact, at the top of, for anyone who managed to get hold of a copy of my paper, there's an interesting quote from Krugman. He says, free trade is not passé, that was the title of a famous article he wrote, but is an idea that has irretrievably lost its innocence. Its status has shifted from optimum to reasonable rule of thumb and can never again be asserted as the policy that economic theory tells us is always right. The world's leading trade economist of today says that. Free trade theory is just simply not always right. And he gives additional grounds. It's very interesting, as a slight aside, we had the president of Switzerland open our conference, and a lot of you would have heard that, and I was very pleased to hear him. But some of you may remember that he said, globalisation is inevitable because of today's technology and economies of scale. And they mean that we have to have globalisation whether we like it or not. Does that mean globalisation is not an option? Even if nobody wants it, but we've still got to have it. Now, the point is that he mentioned economies of scale. But according to Krugman's theories, if you have economies of scale, that gives rise to a situation where if you assist an industry, it can improve itself and make itself more efficient. That's what economies of scale and increasing return says. So that actually gives grounds for more intervention by governments to promote those sort of industries. And that's what Krugman says. Krugman actually, oddly enough, claims to be a free trader. But he says, on the same grounds as Marshall, he says free trade is safer because we don't trust governments. But it's not necessarily better. And the situation of increasing returns is the one major circumstance in which Krugman, for instance, accepts intervention. He says that's an absolutely logical situation for government intervention. So those of you from Switzerland might, if you next time you're talking to your president, might just mention that, that he actually got it the wrong way around. And it's actually a grounds for intervention. Now, I mentioned before that there are two aspects of trade theory, the comparative advantage and gains from trade. And comparative advantage could be argued to be valid, but it is oversimplified. It's comparative advantage can be determined historically, could be manipulated by government, and there are grounds for intervention there. But see, some people, a lot of Marxists, for instance, play around with the numbers that Steve had there, and they come up with a conclusion that comparative advantage is actually wrong. And I'm not sure that I agree with any that I've read. Comparative advantage at the simple level seems to be a valid theory, except that it's oversimplified. You can actually intervene to manipulate your own comparative advantage. The issue that really I think the critics of free trade should be concentrating on is the gains from trade theory. And this is where you find a surprising amount of challenge. The stuff I've been talking about mainstream economists questioning it is in this area of the gains from trade. They say that the gains from trade are not absolutely certain. And all the people I've just been mentioning say that. I'll try and whiz through quickly three areas in which I challenge this whole idea of gains from trade. The first part of it, on page 2 of the paper, I call the swings and roundabouts aspect. And I have to try and abbreviate what I've got to say here. What I call the swings and roundabouts aspect of trade theory is where I question this idea that so many people have, that the gains from trade are automatic and that everyone can always get them. If you look at the main sort of theory that's used about this in textbooks, not the diagrams that Steve put up, but another diagram, which is reproduced on the last page of my paper, if anyone's got it there in front of them, page 6, a standard diagram that explains this shows some lines here, with the line PW being the world price under free trade. When you go to protection, the price goes up to what I've labelled as PT there, and you open up some little squares and triangles that I've labelled A, B, C and D. What happens when you go to protection is that local industry gets a benefit and government gets a benefit from the revenue. Then if you switch back to free trade, you lose all those benefits. But all those benefits go to consumers. The only reason why there is supposedly gains from trade is that there are those little triangles there called Harbinger triangles, after the economist who devised them, that I've labelled B and D there, and they're supposed to be triangles of inefficiency, because when you're producing industries that you're not efficient at, you get those areas of what's called dead weight loss or inefficiency. When you go to free trade, you lose those triangles of inefficiency. So the gains from trade do not come from extra exports or something like that. You have to think about it. When a country liberalises its trade, you might be able to get more exports, but you have to import more as well. You're not necessarily going to be better off. That's a balance of payments issue. The gains from trade don't come through the balance of payments. The gains from trade, according to mainstream theory, come through efficiency, through making your economy more efficient, supposedly. And that's why supposedly every country can gain, even if they don't, even if other countries don't liberalise. So it's supposed to come from efficiency. But if you look at what happens with efficiency and restructuring, what have you got to do? You've got to do what Steve was outlining. You've got to change. This is the golden rule of free trade, that thou shalt change. You must have structural change. You cannot go from protection to free trade without changing the structure of your economy. And then you run into the problems that Steve was talking about, all the social adjustments, which economists basically ignore. They just talk about suboptimal relocation of workers and things like that. So this is the first major problem, and this is why I call it swings and roundabouts. The benefits go from one industry to another, and one individual to another. And according to free trade theory, the way in which people accumulate, it's supposed to go to a consumption, and it's generally believed, according to Steve's diagrams, it goes to consumption. But actually, if you look at this diagram, it goes to a triangle there that economists call consumer surplus. It doesn't go to directly to consumption and directly to new income. It goes to what economists call consumer surplus. Consumer surplus is what happens when prices are lower than you expect them to be. And you don't actually get direct income, you get extra, what economists call utility or satisfaction. And then that is supposed to translate into higher disposable income and into higher overall income and then into higher GDP. But there's actually a lot of steps along the way. You get the impression from the World Economic Forum and so on that there's this automatic gift that comes from free trade. And economists have never argued that. They've argued that there's a series of steps. In the middle of it is this thing called consumer surplus. And what a lot of economists don't realise is that some of their own colleagues in the area of so-called welfare economics about 20 years ago discussed this theory. And they came up with the conclusion that consumer surplus is slightly theoretical and it may not be real income. It may not be proportionate to the liberalisation. And so, in fact, within the economics discipline, there is this questioning of the real meaning of the so-called consumer surplus, which is supposed to be the great benefit. And there are a number of hidden assumptions to this whole thing about whether or not consumer surplus is going to be of great benefit. And they make the assumptions, the sorts of assumptions, that Steve was talking about. It's based on assumptions like that these utility units are meaningful, that all consumers have the same sort of preferences for income, but that mightn't be the case. In fact, very often it isn't the case. And it's also assumed that these little loss triangles in my diagram, which are supposedly dead weight loss, don't have any benefit. But a lot of economists like Krugman are now pointing out that it's a thing called learning benefits, or learning by doing. So if you establish an industry under protection, an import substitution industry, and you have learning benefits, you can actually improve. And that's what's happened in a lot of third world countries, even though the World Bank says that these import substitution industries under protection were inefficient. There's a lot of evidence that they actually weren't. And I've been going through the literature and it's absolutely amazing how many studies I've come up with which suggest that those sort of protected industries in the early stages of development were quite efficient. And I've seen a study from Zimbabwe recently which found that very few of the old industries were inefficient. If the World Bank says they're all inefficient, they've got to go for export industries. And it's quite staggering that, you know, there's all that literature there that says that that's simply not true. So I'm running out of time, I think, to go into it all, but the next section is assumptions, aspects, and the free trade theory relies on an amazing number of assumptions, not just the ones I mentioned, but it assumes perfect competition, it assumes that there are no monopolies and oligopolies, equal preferences, it assumes full employment. Now, if you haven't got full employment, when you start off with full employment, when you go to free trade and people lose their jobs, if people go into the unemployment, just go into unemployment, their income doesn't go up. So welfare benefits actually don't go up. And the same sort of thing with what I call the non-economic issues that economists don't even go into at all. If free trade damages your culture, undermines your sovereignty and so on, that's even further arguments against free trade. Now, I've come up with a new theory of my own that I call free trade a contingency theory. These benefits are only contingent on a whole lot of things like this, that the income being distributed the right way through the right in the right direction, that a country's situation be right to absorb it. And I also use another term that I call the capacity to gain from trade. You won't find this in the textbook, this is my term. That countries do not automatically gain from trade. As I said, this is what Samuelson has hinted at but not gone into very much. And what I'm trying to argue in more detail is that there are reasons why countries may not gain from trade. The World Trade Organization, the whole GATT agreement is set up on the assumption that virtually all countries will virtually always gain from trade. And yet the mainstream theorists haven't said that. And I'm trying to give extra reasons as to why it's not true. There are lots of circumstances in which countries don't gain from trade. And to have a global agreement based on the idea that all countries always gain from trade, it's quite simply not true, and it's amazingly invalid. And if what I say is true, then what we need is an alternative global order. It's one that's simply much more flexible and allows countries to intervene in their own ways. I'm not arguing for very high protection, but and so on. And I'm not arguing for export promotion of your own. I don't believe that's justified. But I'm arguing for justified intervention where a country can economically and socially gain and make a judgment for themselves. I want to just finish off with two descriptions of my overall descriptions of this. In sum, I argue that free trade is not as simple and unambiguously beneficial a process as globalizers claim. It's a complex, organic, transformative process involving redistributive swings and roundabouts with outcomes which are socially, socio-economically determined, very often politically. It's an indirect, ambiguous, non-automatic process with possible gains from trade being determined by various circumstantial, non-economic factors and contingent upon every country's gains from trade capacity. And I've come up with a little metaphor that I rather like. Free trade is rather like modern drug therapy. Miracles are theoretically possible, and do sometimes happen through free trade, but costs can be high, resistance tends to increase over time, and there are adverse side effects, usually, and effectiveness depends on the patient's own response mechanisms. And I think that's quite a good analogy, and somebody should tell them down the road about that. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Graham. I think one of the best riposts that I'd heard to the observation Graham made about how globalization is put to us as an immutable force and a natural, unavoidable, inescapable process actually came from Juan Somavia, who is the head of the ILO. He made a rather neat distinction, saying that whilst the technologies you associate with globalization, the information and communication technologies, maybe you can't uninvent them, the policies that go along with those technologies have been made by policymakers and, quite simply, can be changed by policymakers. And I think it's also the case that Paul Krugman, who you were talking about, actually described this impression you're given of the massive costs of protection and the huge benefits of liberalization. He described that as one of
economics' dirty little secrets. And I think it's certainly a dirty little secret to places like, countries like Benin, who are dependent for 84% of their income on cotton, cotton whose price in the global markets has plummeted by a third in just 2 years. Or a country like Ghana, hugely dependent upon exporting cocoa. Increased production, 80% over the course of a decade. And the extra income they got, about 2%. So the market failures are kind of out there and glaring. And I'm just going to hear from Alexandra now, but I just thought I'd tell you about something that a farmer, a small farmer in the Dominican Republic once said to me. It's always kind of created the impression that big industrialized farming, you know, feeding the international markets is supposed to be efficient. But actually, when you look at the figures, there's an inverse relationship between size of farm and efficiency, and it's the small farmers in developing countries who are the most efficient users of natural resources and completely driven to distraction by their inability to get a decent price for anything that they grew. A farmer in the Dominican Republic once said to me that he would grow even fire if he could get a good price for it. Anyway, over to Alexandra from Friends of the Earth.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I hope everyone is still awake. Just let me quickly introduce myself. I'm Alexandra Wandel, and I work for Friends of the Earth Europe in Brussels, and I'm coordinating for International's Trade, Environment and Sustainability Programme for the European region. Now, FAO International is a federation of environmental and social justice groups in more than 68 countries worldwide, and we are campaigning to create sustainable societies. And in order to campaign to have sustainable societies, we also feel it necessary to challenge basically free trade theory and to campaign for the creation of equitable, sustainable and democratic trading system. Now, as you all know, since the WTO ministerial in Seattle, thousands of concerned citizens have been going to the streets in Washington, D.C., in Prague, in Gothenburg, Genoa, to express their concern about corporate-driven globalization. And also today, again in New York, we will see thousands of demonstrators going into the streets. And this is because corporate globalization has real and negative impacts on the day-to-day lives of peoples, of students, women, farmers, indigenous people, and so on and so forth. And there's a growing movement of solidarity among people to create a better world. It's a matter of fact that current trade policies are associated with increasing levels of inequalities, unsustainable resource use, the undermining of cultural and biological diversity, increasing job insecurities, and also the undermining of locally appropriate systems of commerce. This state of the world, as the World Economic Forum calls it, cannot continue. And for Friends of the Earth, the negative impacts that we are seeing, they're directly, of course, a result of flaws in free trade theory. So in my short presentation, I want to go quickly into mention five major flaws of free trade theory, and then address some positive elements we have developed in Friends of the Earth International. In FAO, we see an urgent need to break the taboo on criticizing free trade theory and to free up creative thinking in universities and governmental circles to improve our economic system, because we believe that nothing can change until this taboo is broken. As you all know, in most governmental and academic circles, including over there in the World Economic Forum, but for instance also at the moment there are the preparations going on in the United Nations for the World Summit for Sustainable Development, in all these circles, in the official circles, it is currently taboo to criticize and discuss the failures of free trade theory. So let's discuss it here at the Public Eye in Davos. Governments often argue that environmental and social impacts that NGOs are linking with globalization are not a direct result, and that there's no real link, and they often argue basically that more globalization rather than less is the solution. But if we look closely at free trade theory, as we've been doing it this morning, we can explain in a theoretical rather than empirical way why free trade is often not a win-win, but rather a win-lose situation. So my first point also goes back to the theory of comparative advantage, which we already discussed in detail this morning. So as we already heard, this theory basically states that countries should specialize in products, what they are best at, and then trade with other countries. But this theory developed in the 18th century was developed when capital was firmly anchored in domestic economies. And today, with open borders and the development of new information technologies, capital can be moved virtually instantaneously. This can lead, of course, to economic instabilities and the lowering of international standards as companies compete in the global market. In our point of view, it is those basically that are holding the winning cards, those that basically have an absolute advantage, that are winning, and most others are losing out. This analysis has, by the way, also been confirmed already by a trade negotiator who has been involved in the Uruguay round of negotiations in the WTO from Ghana. And I also would like to quote the respected economist Herman Daly, who has also criticized the theory of comparative advantage, and he says, and I quote, "Economists have suppressed recognition of the fact that the empirical cornerstone of the whole classical free trade theory argument, capital immobility, has crumbled into loose gravel." My second point is the whole point of how we measure economic progress. How do we measure it? We measure it at the moment with GDP, gross domestic product. But GDP does not indicate whether our economies are actually performing well. They do not measure quality of life, poverty eradication, human development, environmental protection. Instead, if there's crime prevention because of increasing crime, or if we see that there's medical treatment because people are becoming sick, or we see, for instance, the cleaning up of an oil spill, all these economic transactions are basically boosting GDP, although they are indicating a worsening of life. In addition, GDP, of course, also does not value the valuable work such as care of children and of the elderly. Now, research by the New Economics Foundation and also by Friends of the Earth in the UK show that there are alternative indexes that can give very different results of measuring economic development. In general, for instance, if you look at statistics in Europe, you can see that while in the last 30 years GDP went up, from the 70s or 80s on, around other indexes that I mentioned, basically went down. Now, while our governments still work on the basis that trade liberalization is increasing GDP, and therefore it must be good, we need to underline that we also need to look at other aspects of economic well-being. The third point I want to mention is the whole point of unsustainability. When free trade theory was originally developed as a solution to the world's economic problems, there was no real understanding that resources would be so limited. But our current economic model is based on increasing unsustainable rates of resources. It basically also ignores that increasing consumption is depleting the so-called natural capital on which our global economy is based on. For instance, there are some highly interesting statistics provided by the United Nations Environment Programme that is showing the devastating impacts of trade liberalization in relation, for instance, to tropical forests or overfishing. For instance, in the area of overfishing, export-led development has led to the fact that in the moment 60% are at or near the point of which yields start to decline. Another good example is, for instance, if you look at the development in the Philippines, in the forest sector, for instance. Between the 60s and the 70s, Philippines was among the four top timber exporters. Right now, 90% of the forests have been lost. And in the meantime, the Philippines need to import forest products. And you have 80 million impoverished forest dwellers, plus an external debt of 48 billion US dollars and one third of the population living under the poverty line. These are quite shocking figures. An additional point why we feel free trade theory is unsustainable also is that the whole economic model is not internalizing environmental costs, and that's particularly relevant if you look at the whole sector of transport, which was already mentioned by Andrew beforehand, because we have subsidized long distance transport, and that means that we have highly polluting and habitat destroying forms of production, and that basically international trade is favored over local trade and production, and that we have a high level of fuel consumption, partly because of the nature, but also because of the volume of goods transported. The other point now is the non-natural resource use efficiency. Basically, what you can see is in the economic transaction that only financial and economic efficiency is taken into account, but not environmental and ecological aspects. That basically leads to the whole fact that we can see basically the drive and the global race to the bottom, where companies need to relocate to the cheapest locations. And that, of course, can have dramatic impact for environment, for global climate change, and so on and so forth. Another important point for us is the so-called argument of the level playing field. That's an argument that is one of the most used terms in international trade talk. And for us, the whole question is, international level playing field. That, of course, can only be relevant, right, if you have two equal partners. But how can you speak about level playing field if you speak about competition between small and medium-sized enterprises and large transnational corporations? So how can they compete, for instance, with companies such as Monsanto, Mitsubishi, and Microsoft? So for us, this is also something to be challenged and to be questioned. Now, I would like to now, after I just mentioned a few critical points and some of the major flaws, I want to come to some of the alternative points. Friends of the Earth believe strongly that economics needs to be updated to the needs of the 21st century. As said beforehand, it needs to be flexible, it needs to be fair, it needs to be sustainable, exactly the opposite of what it is today. And it needs to be more than only about money, profit, and growth. Now, in Friends of the Earth International, after the trade talks collapsed in Seattle, we have started a longer process within a global network where we really have a whole spread of groups working all over in all continents about how we actually also want to envisage positive proposals for alternative sustainable economies. And I want to outline some elements which we have basically discussed. The first point is to say that we believe that we need to have diverse economy. That's a very important point for us. Sustainable economies need to permit the development of diverse economies, and that means that it needs to be broadened to include environmental and social concerns, of course. Diversity is needed in that sense that we need to have diversity of economic strategies, but also of diverse sectors, that we can avoid to have, you know, economic monopolies and mergers and acquisitions, and to have diverse economies. For us, it's important that we have principles and that we change course and establish new goals. And among these goals, it's important for us to establish principles rather than profit. Among one of the principles for us, for instance, is important that there would be respect for high environmental, social, safety, environmental, and labor standards, that we have also as principles to have equity between and among generations, that we have respect for diversity, biological, cultural, but also economic, that we have as another principle democratic and public accountability of our governments, but also of economies, that we also try to enshrine important international principles such as the precautionary principle or the polluters pay principle, and include environmental liability questions. So we have basically developed a whole series, and you will find, I will just mention a few of them, but you will find at the end of this room we have put out some documents where everything is listed more in detail. The document is called Towards Sustainable Economies. Another important point for us is the whole point of measuring economic welfare accurately. That goes back to the whole point I mentioned beforehand about GDP. So let's get smart and let's do it better. And let's find new measurements that really can take into account quality of life, valuing unpaid work. Because contributions also such as childcare, subsistence farming, also voluntary work are very essential and important, need to be valued. And of course also we need to think about integrating the environmental and social costs of transport, for instance, so that trade patterns can also shift more towards the local. Cutting resource use and consumption is my next point. So our basic point is to say we need to basically stop having economic theories in which countries need to compete for very scarce resources, but we rather should focus on how we actually can reduce resource use, of course primarily in the north, and how we can ensure people to have access to these resources. Because reducing resource use primarily in the north is more likely, we think, to bring peace and security than to just, you know, continue business as usual with neoliberal economic globalization and a global race to the bottom. In our point of view, people should have the right to restrict the use and sale of their resources in order to eliminate overconsumption and to ensure that people around the world have access to resources. Fifth point I want to mention is the importance of rebalancing trade and to reinvigorate local economies, because at the moment the focus is so much on international trade, and we see a clear need to rebalance trade in order to develop and have a higher priority again on local and regional economies and trade. Whilst of course international trade to a certain degree is desirable, we feel that healthy and sustainable economies are key to meeting people's needs. But they are unfortunately currently undermined by trade liberalization policies, because smaller business, for instance, can impossibly compete with large transnational corporations. The sixth point is about sharing resources, reducing inequalities and poverty. And here I want to come back to the whole concept and notion which is very important for us. It's the concept of ecological debt. That's also a concept that has so far is completely ignored in the whole discussions about free trade and also in the economic and academic circles. So basically what we see today is that you have heavy debt burdens that encourage government to allow increased exploitation of their natural resources for exports in order to generate foreign exchanges. Now, export-led development programs of the World Bank and of the IMF have led basically to a vicious circle. So you have world markets that are oversupplied, commodity prices are tumbling, and then it's basically leading to poverty-stricken countries. So basically, we in the rich importing countries have at the moment ready access to very cheap supplies of natural resources, and therefore in our point of view, we in the north have basically incurred an ecological debt to the south that needs to be acknowledged and that needs to be relieved. And the last point for us, which is very central, and I'm sure if you have attended the public eye in Davos beforehand, you have heard a lot about it beforehand already, it's the whole point about regulating transnational corporations, making them fully and fairly accountable to local communities and elected governments, and giving communities and citizens to the right for legal redress, to put duties on corporations and to ensure that their rules to ensure high standards. So basically, I don't want to speak too long because we also want to have some time to have discussions, of course. So as you all know, this has been some ideas developed in the Faux Network. We basically really want to start and inspire and have an open debate with citizens around the world how basically to improve the trading system, because it cannot continue like this. And so let's be creative in thinking, because as people say increasingly all over the world, and as people also all say now today as we meet here in New York, but also as people are gathering actually today in Porto Alegre at the World Social Forum, another world is possible. Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.